Every day we use it to wash dishes, make our meals, clean our bodies, quench our thirst. But do you know where your water comes from and where it goes once you pull the plug? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we trace the origins of our aging water infrastructure and find out why we need a new approach to urban water systems. In the first half hour, we'll hear from David Sedlak, a water expert from the University of California at Berkeley. He says we need to revolutionize the way we handle drinking and wastewater. Then in the second half hour, we focus on local water issues to find out what specific water worries face some of our communities. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Turn on the faucet and the water pours out. Pull out the plug and that dirty water disappears. Every day we use it to wash dishes, make our meals, clean our bodies, quench our thirst. But do you know where your water comes from? The journey it takes to your tap? And where it disappears to when it runs down the drain? And what happens to it after that? My first guest is David Sedlak. He's a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of California in Berkeley, also co-director of the Berkeley Water Center, and author of a new book titled Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. In the book, he tells the story of the systems that bring us our drinking water, how they were developed, the problems they're facing, and how they'll have to be reinvented in the very near future. Next week, David Sedlak will be visiting Iowa at the University of Iowa on Friday, the 19th of September. He'll be giving a public talk on sustainable urban water infrastructure as part of the Rich Valentine Lecture Series hosted by the University of Iowa Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. That's at 3:30 at the Becker Communication Studies Building on the UI campus. David Sedlak joins us by phone for this first half hour. Hello, David.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. Very interesting book you have here. Water 4.0, we want to talk about 4.0, which represents the generation, the revolution in water to come. But first of all, take us through the revolutions 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0 that you detail in your book.
Okay, Ben. Well, if we think about the changes that happen in water systems as a series of revolutions, which they tend to occur as revolutions because new ideas come around and they quickly spread and become more popular. So I made the analogy to the way we upgrade our computer systems, operating systems, and we renumber them. So the first one is 1.0, and then when something really good comes along that everyone has to have, we call it 2.0. So the first revolution in urban water, the one I call 1.0, is a really ancient idea. And in the book, I give credit for it to the Romans. And they put together ideas that had been kicking around in previous civilizations and created a system for bringing water into their city. And the reason that they had to do this was that Rome had a lot of people and it had a lot of money. And so they were able to build imported water systems, canals and aqueducts, that could supply people with about 100 gallons of water per person per day, which is similar to what we use in many of our cities today. So a real accomplishment in the ancient world. And that accomplishment kind of withered away with the fall of the Roman Empire and didn't get rediscovered again until the Industrial Revolution, when cities started to once again exceed 1 million people. And so in the second half of the 19th century, you had big European cities like London and Paris growing to have more than 1 million people. And then a little bit later on, you had American cities like New York and Philadelphia and Chicago growing large and needing an imported water system. And they basically adopted the same principle that the Romans developed of a gravity-fed imported water system, but with a difference. And that difference was because they had the steam engine and because they had water wheels, they were able to pressurize the water and deliver it to people's homes. And suddenly water became plentiful and cheap, and that made it very convenient to use lots of water inside the house. And so we developed flowing water, and we replaced the outhouse with toilets, and we had a lot of human waste that suddenly needed to go somewhere. And that human waste went into the sewers, which before that time were really only being used to drain cities. So putting all of that waste into sewers and eventually into rivers created the need for the second revolution. So Water 2.0 was the drinking water treatment process that was developed in response to the diseases caused by disposing of all our sewage and rivers. So if you live downstream from a big city, suddenly your water supply had all of these pathogenic microorganisms in them, and they started making people sick with things like typhoid and cholera. And so the drinking water treatment system, which really just consisted of passing water through a sand filter and then later figuring out how to add chlorine to the water to make it even safer, that innovation made it possible for us to drink sewage contaminated water. And it's been estimated that people in the United States that our lifespans increased by somewhere around 15 years after most cities adopted this second revolution of drinking water treatment.
And then the third generation has to do with what we do with our water once we use it. When did that come into play?
Well, so starting in the 20th century, people started to complain about all this sewage going into rivers. And the idea of treating sewage before putting it in a river didn't make a lot of sense to the engineers who were trying to protect public health as a drinking water supply. It only made sense when we started to worry about all the damage that that sewage was causing to the aquatic environment. So in the 30s and 40s and 50s, people started to notice that progressively our lakes and rivers and estuaries were dying, and people would complain about the Great Lakes going downhill or the Potomac River or San Francisco Bay. And this technology of sewage treatment, which had been developed initially in the 1920s, did not become popular until society came together and realized that this was a big problem and we had to spend some money and do something about it. And so the Clean Water Act and the environmental movement of the early 1970s led to the decision to spend lots of money in upgrading our sewage treatment plants and putting in the modern sewage treatment infrastructure we have today, which has gone a long way in terms of making our waterways swimmable, drinkable, and fishable.
So tell us, David, let's take a cup of water that I'm drinking where did it come from? Where was it prior to coming out of the faucet at my home, those water molecules?
Oh, gee, well, if you're in Iowa, I'm not sure exactly about all the details of your water system, but if you're using surface water like many people in the United States, that water came out of a river. And that river might have had a sewage treatment plant discharging into it. It might have had a farm, and the runoff from the farm could have been going into it. And that water flowed into a drinking water treatment plant that looks a lot like those drinking water treatment plants that were designed at the turn of the century. The water passes through a sand filter, and then it's disinfected, usually with chlorine, and then it's put in those pipes and pumped up to your house.
Mm-hmm. Now, our waste, take us through that process. What happens?
Well, so you put some water down the drain, or you flush the toilet, or you take a shower, or your washing machine discharges into the sewer, and that water goes into a sewage treatment plant. And again, a sewage treatment plant with the technology that was originally developed in about the 1920s. The big particles, the heavy things, settle out like sand and heavy material, and then the rest goes through a biological treatment process where bacteria break down the organic matter and do what used to happen in our rivers to purify the water. And then perhaps it goes through a sand filter, or perhaps it goes through a chlorine disinfection process, and it goes back out into the environment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have set the stage for what you're calling Water 4.0. We have a highly centralized system in our cities of dealing with water, distributing it to homes and businesses, and then taking back the wastewater to treat it. Why do we need to move on to something new? What's happening?
Well, the The issue with water is that it's very place specific. So in some parts of the country, the problem is there's not enough water for everyone. And so in California, for example, we're in the middle of our worst drought in modern history. But that same drought exists in Texas and until recently was plaguing the Colorado River watershed. And so places that don't have enough water need something more than this ancient idea of imported water, because there are no more reservoirs and imported water systems to build. In places like where you are, there might be too much water. So we built our water systems during a time when the precipitation patterns were different. And now that we have more people and more paved surfaces and we're experiencing more severe weather events, that water can flood our cities. And I think you've experienced that
Yes, we have.
Yeah,
our 500-year floods are coming much more frequently in that. In fact, when we talk of wastewater, is it true that we get floods and then it overwhelms some of our systems in our cities? And sometimes wastewater, pure wastewater, has to be put out into the rivers, as in the olden times.
Sure. So actually, the systems that you have were designed to overflow, but only to overflow a few times a year. And as we get more and more people using the system and bigger storms, those events become more frequent. So it's either too much water or too little water. And the systems we have just really aren't up for the challenges that they're facing.
Okay. So what is the revolution that this crisis brewing? What do we need to do that's completely different than what we're doing now?
Well, I'll tell you about a couple of examples that your listeners may be less familiar with because you're in the wet part of the country. In terms of water supply, we can see the blueprints of the revolution being made in Southern California, where the imported water that used to come from Northern California or the Colorado River is no longer considered to be secure in the long term. And so in Southern California, we're doing a lot of water recycling. That is, we're taking that water that comes out of the sewage treatment plant, we're applying additional treatment processes, and then we're putting it back into the water supply intentionally. So maybe in the past it's happened accidentally, but now we're actually either taking that highly purified sewage effluent and putting it into a drinking water aquifer or pumping it into a reservoir, or, as is starting to happen now in Texas, putting it directly into the water distribution system. So that's one approach. The other approach that we're seeing in Southern California is that we're starting to capture rainwater or stormwater runoff that falls in our cities, and we're holding on to it and turning it back into drinking water. And those local water sources, either recycling wastewater effluent or capturing urban stormwater and putting it back into the water supply, are going to start to make up a larger and larger fraction of the water supply in Southern California.
Mm-hmm. What about conservation? We try to do that now, some of us better than others. And I know in California, Southern California, they have become very good at conserving water out of the necessity. What role will that play in the future?
Well, again, if you look ahead to places like Southern California, where there's been a lot of pressure on water, we've come about as far as we're going to go, or we can see the end of the line in terms of indoor water conservation. So you can replace the old toilets with low flush toilets and the shower heads, and you can move from top loading washing machines to front loaders. But at some point, you're done with conservation. The real forefront for conservation now is outdoor water use. And that turns out to be a harder battle than it looked like, because people really love having a lawn. And in an arid climate, when you don't have a lawn, it's hotter and dustier around your house. And so you have to find a compromise where you landscape the area around your house in a way that's attractive and uses less water.
If you've just joined us, my guest is David Sedlak. He's author of a new book titled Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. He'll be visiting the University of Iowa campus next week to speak on sustainable urban water systems. Centralization has been a hallmark of all the previous revolutions, but you say part of what is necessary, what needs to come, is decentralization. In what form do you see that?
Well, the first place where we're going to see a move away from centralized systems is in the wastewater area. And I think many people in Iowa are already familiar with the fact that if you live in a community with a low population density, you might be served by a septic tank and a leach field. That's a 19th century technology. And so with 21st century technologies that take their cue from bioengineering and material sciences and computing, we can make, if you will, a modern septic system that could work in a suburban neighborhood. And so it's possible for us to start building residential communities that don't have to hook up to a centralized wastewater treatment.
And that's preferable. Why?
Well, it's very expensive. So when you build these pipes, when you extend the pipes from your centralized sewage treatment plant to a new community on the edge of the city, that's an expense not only in terms of creating the new infrastructure, but the burden it puts on the older infrastructure. And if you're in a place that has combined sewer systems, that new hookup is going to exacerbate the problem with these combined sewer overflows that happen when it rains. The other thing is that in places that don't have enough water, that those modern versions of the septic tank can be used as a source of landscape irrigation water. And so we could treat our own waste from a residential development and then reuse that water for landscaping and don't have to use tap water on our lawns in those new communities.
We have about 5 minutes left, David. What other components do you see coming our way in terms of how we will treat water differently in the future?
Well, looking beyond the shores of the United States, we see that seawater desalination has reached a much more efficient point than it was at 10 or 20 years ago. And so when the millennial drought hit in Australia, for example, every one of their major cities put in a seawater desalination plant. And now the city of Perth in Australia is getting about half of its drinking water from ocean desalination. And the same is true in Israel and increasingly in Spain. And so we could see that some places will opt for seawater desalination as a drinking water supply. I think that we'll also see some real innovations in this area of urban drainage. And you can see cities that are on the forefront of green infrastructure, like Philadelphia and Indianapolis, moving away from the idea of putting all of its rainwater into pipes and sending it to a sewage treatment plant or to a river and using that water to create green spaces within the city. And I think we'll see a lot more of that as well.
As you described earlier, moving from one water revolution to the next was necessary because there was some sort of crisis happened to propel us, to make people rethink water and do something entirely different. Based on these previous water revolutions, do you think there will necessarily be a need to have a crisis to motivate us in these new ways?
Well, I'll tell you something about crises. If we have another winter that's as dry as last winter in California, that C word with a capital C is going to be on everyone's lips. So the water supply crisis is going to happen eventually in the western United States. So it's either an extended drought like we're undergoing now or some realization of what climate change means to water supplies. And I think the other crisis that may be driving this change already in the northern part of the country are these combined sewer overflow problems. So I just gave you the example of Philadelphia and Indianapolis becoming leaders in green infrastructure. That was necessitated by lawsuits that were filed against them for polluting surface waters. And so they saw green infrastructure as a potentially less expensive option than the traditional way of building networks of pipes to get rid of the urban runoff.
Here in Iowa, we don't face the same water shortages that have plagued Southern California, but we usually have plentiful water, though we have had droughts in recent years. Talk about contaminants that we might not know are in our water, in drinking water.
Well, To flip it around to Iowa, I think there's a contaminant that you know is in your drinking water, and I think that maybe we should pay attention to some of the herbicides that are present in agricultural runoff, like atrazine. But if we are going to think about some of the newly discovered contaminants, we're going to keep finding them, and they're coming from not only what we put down the sewer, but what we use, you know, the modern paints and coatings we put on the sides of our houses, the materials we use in our automobiles, the chemicals that we use in industry. As we get better and better at detecting chemicals in the environment, we're going to discover more and more. And I think the challenge for the scientific community is trying to prioritize and decide which ones truly pose risks to human health.
This overhaul of our water system sounds very comprehensive. It's going to cost quite a bit, I assume. How will it be paid for?
Well, Ben, you know, what's happening now in water is that the price of water in most parts of the country is going up by about 5% a year. And that's about the point where people start to cry uncle and say enough is enough. And so I predict that we'll see this increase in the price of water at rates greater than inflation in most places. And then when we have a crisis, people are going to need to spend more. And so, you know, the idea of a revolution is that you develop the technologies and approaches in the places that are dealing with the crises, and then eventually people see the wisdom in doing that, and they adopt those technologies before the crisis arises. Mm-hmm. So if I had a crystal ball, I would predict a slow progression of more and more cities doing Water 4.0 as a response to a crisis, and then eventually others just saying, you know what, the next time we rebuild our system, let's adopt these approaches instead of what we're doing now, because it makes sense in the long run.
Is there anything that individuals can do right now, listening right now, concerned about water quality and the issues that you're talking about?
Sure. I mean, you know, what I always think about here, where the water we put down the sewer may become part of our drinking water supply later, is think the way someone does who lives in a home with a septic tank. Something that goes down the drain is not gone forever. And so there are some household products that we could consider moving away from that might be difficult to remove in the drinking water treatment process. I also think that even if you live in a place that's wet, you can adopt landscaping practices around your home that either cut down on the amount of runoff or require less water if you're in a place that you need to irrigate. Mm-hmm. And so all of these things add up slowly. But in the book, what I say is the most important thing a person can do is to become politically active in the process of pushing for the next revolution. Because right now, the decisions about how to spend money on water infrastructure are done at the municipal utility level and the city government level. And people need to hear that we're interested in a different vision and a more sustainable future.
So you're saying to motivate the people who make the decisions, they need to have that pressure from below, from the grassroots, to make them think more in terms of long-term solutions rather than focusing on day-to-day problems.
Exactly.
Okay. Very good. David, you'll be here next week as a part of a lecture series, Water 4.0, the past, present, and future of the world's most vital resource. Thank you for being on our program. Quickly, why is chlorine in our water?
Chlorine is in our water mainly to protect us from the waterborne pathogens that can make us sick. So it's the second half of Water 2.0, the drinking water treatment technology.
Okay, that's also something we'll talk about in the second half hour. But thank you very much, David Sedlak, professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of California in Berkeley, co-director of Berkeley's Water Center, author of Water 4.0, the past, present, and future of the world's most vital resource. David, thank you very much. We look forward to welcoming you to Iowa next week.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll continue to focus on water, but more local water issues and some people who can talk about local water issues. Bill Still will join us. He's the Waterworks CEO and General Manager for Des Moines. Also, Brent Hinson, City Administrator in Washington, Iowa. And David Swertny, he's at the UI. We'll talk more about water quality and our water systems after a short break. It's River to River. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Here's something you might not know. The jazz great Al Jarreau lived in Iowa in the 1960s. In fact, he attended the University of Iowa. Tomorrow on this program, my conversation with Al Jarreau. He's also coming to Iowa to visit his alma mater next week and to perform in Iowa City. Today, water and water worries are topic. Last half hour, we got the big picture of how we've handled water in the past, the present, and a look to the future, needs in the future, how changes may be upon us sooner than we think. This half hour, we want to focus upon local water issues to find out what specific water worries we're facing in some of our communities. We'd like to have you join us as well. What questions do you have about how we handle our drinking and waste water? Does your community have a noticeable water problem? Tell us about it. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining us this half hour, Bill Stowe is with us, Des Moines Waterworks CEO and General Manager in our Des Moines studio. Bill Stowe, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Ben. Great to be here.
Joining us by phone, Brent Hinson. He is City Administrator in Washington, Iowa. Hi, Brent.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Ben.
And in our Iowa City studio, David Swertny. He is Associate Professor in Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Iowa, part of the group that is bringing David Sedlak to Iowa to speak. Thank you for coming, David.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about, we've got a big town, a city, Des Moines, and a smaller city in Washington. Let's talk about some of the problems that each of you are encountering. What are the biggest challenges you're facing, Bill Stowe, in Des Moines?
Well, Ben, I'm going to be surprised whether there's a lot of difference across the state of Iowa in problems, no matter what the size of the community is. Here in Des Moines, Des Moines Waterworks serves about 500,000 folks, not only in Des Moines, but in our suburban neighbors. The largest concern for us on a day-to-day basis is the surface water quality of the Des Moines and Raccoon Rivers that we draw our drinking water from. This is a heavily agricultural state, and its land use is upstream from Des Moines on both rivers. And so we face the contamination of agricultural pollution coming down to us and then delivering to our doorstep very nutrient-rich water that we have to treat for delivery to our customers, some of whom are rural folks also. We serve really four counties here in the metro area. So we have some agricultural users, but most of our users are urban and suburban users who pay a fairly significant price to remove contaminants that are coming to us from chemical pollutants put on the fields, but also a growing concern about animal feeding operations and the waste coming from hogs, cattle, and other livestock that are upriver from us here in Des Moines.
When you talk about those nutrients being one of your biggest challenges, can you filter out those nutrients for the most part, or is something left in there?
Yeah, filtration is certainly part of it. But we, like any water utility, are focused on meeting regulatory requirements that are set for us by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Being able to remove nitrate concentrations in particular is of great concern to us. Last year, as an example, we were almost unsuccessful within parts per million of violating those standards. We did not violate the standards, but we're still very concerned about not only meeting that challenge, but the cost of meeting that challenge, which ultimately is borne by our customers.
Mm-hmm. What can you do there in Des Moines to get better water coming downstream?
Well, certainly we think it's absolutely vital that regulation step forward to protect our source waters, as both of our co-guests can certainly attest to, as urban and suburban users and point source polluters into our rivers through our wastewater treatment plants in particular, but through some other industrial sources, we're heavily regulated. Unfortunately, agricultural users upstream from us are largely unregulated. So focusing on the problem and the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy, which is a very significant white paper from Iowa State University, the Department of Natural Resources, the Iowa Department of Agriculture, all point to agricultural uses as being the primary contributors to pollution in our state. We need to focus on regulating those polluters into our water systems. And unfortunately, that's a political issue with a lot of resistance, as you can imagine.
Brent Hinson, your city administrator in Washington, Iowa, what are the biggest challenges you face? Are they much different than what we're hearing from Bill Stowe?
They are, in a way. I would say our largest issues are aging infrastructure, and then there's certainly been a very important impact from mandates for especially improved wastewater quality. That's having a major impact on Iowa communities. In Washington, for example, a town of 7,000 people, we spent $20 million on wastewater improvements within the last 3 years.
So you're struggling to meet EPA and DNR regulations.
Sure, sure. And of course, they're very well intentioned. As Mr. Stowe said, the point source dischargers, which were a point source discharger as a municipal wastewater plant, have had mandates, have had things that have been required of them. Additionally, here as the DNR and as other groups attempt to kind of get a handle on the pollution issues in Iowa's waterways, certainly the non-point source, the ag uses and those sorts of things have been a lot less touched by that level of regulation. You know, I think the mandates are very well intentioned. I think that we can all get on board with the idea of improved water quality in the state, but certainly $20 million does not spread very thinly over 7,000 people.
Brent Hinson, you said you've got an old water infrastructure. How old?
As far as on the drinking water side, we have a variety of things that need to be done in our drinking water utility. I think that points to another problem that is kind of a particularly small town problem. And I think that's complacency. Many towns, and Washington's just one of many, that probably over the years the city council took pride in, we haven't increased our water rates in 15 years or whatever that number may be. I guess I'd submit that's nothing to be proud of, because ultimately what's happened in those cases, and Washington is a definite example of this, we're far behind.
How old is your sewer system or your water mains?
Well, Washington is a pretty old community. We just celebrated our 175th anniversary as a community earlier this summer. There's many pieces of our infrastructure that are well in excess of 100 years old. Our original sewer, I believe, was put in the 1870s. That's still in use. We have 125-year-old water mains that are still in use. There's a definite, and we're certainly seeing where that the water infrastructure in particular is really wearing out. I kind of tracked our water main breaks here over the last 15 years. Each of the last 4 years we've had 30 or more water main breaks. If you look at the previous 10 years before that, there were only 2 years where we had more than 30 water main breaks.
And those cost how much money?
Oh, it's very significant. It's a highly inefficient way to repair your system if you're just fixing it one break at a time. When you're having multiple water main breaks in a particular area, that water main is telling you that it's time to be replaced. We've tried to do that. We've tried to really target our trouble spots and see that we're doing water main replacements in those areas. But obviously, money is always limited, and there's challenges there as well.
So millions of dollars to make those repairs every year in your budget, I assume.
Oh yeah, no. I would say as far as our overall budget, the capital impact of those water main improvements is not nearly as large as like it would be on the water treatment side, either wastewater or drinking water treatment side or water storage, drilling new wells, because we're not like Des Moines, where Des Moines has a surface water plant. We have deep wells that go into the Jordan Aquifer. It's those types of the capital expenditures that are really the most expensive. But with sewer, on the sewer side, for example, we do have the size of our total size of our budget annually pursuer is around $2 million. Of that, we're spending about 10% just on sewer lines, lining, replacement, et cetera.
Brent Hinson, if you just joined us, is with us, City Administrator in Washington, Iowa. Bill Stowe, Des Moines Water Works CEO and General Manager, getting a glimpse of some of the issues, the challenges facing these two different sized cities in terms of their water needs. David Swertny is with us as well, Associate Professor in Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Iowa, part of the group hosting David Sedlak next week to come here to talk about what we think will be the next generation of water, Water 4.0. So, David, you've been listening to Brent and Bill here. Do you hear from these local examples that that we're ready for 4.0?
I believe so. I mean, what's been striking to me is hearing Brent's tale from Washington and how common that is for most small towns that have to develop a reliable water supply. And so the EPA has taken a renewed focus on these small systems. It's something like 97% of the 160,000 public water systems serve less than 10,000 people, and they have all the same challenges that Brent was just describing, the infrastructure challenges, the limited resources. And so in some ways, yes, I believe we are ready for it, where the technologies are coming along and some of the ways we might be able to improve quality. But there is this aspect where all these revolutions that David has talked about in his book require some level of public buy-in, because infrastructure costs are high, and it's the public that ultimately has to shoulder those costs and those burdens. And so that's something that we've been trying to focus here at the University of Iowa on, is increasing education and awareness so that people are much more in tune to the challenges that it takes to develop a reliable and safe water supply, and how, as an engaged citizenry, they can take a more active voice in this sort of sustainable water future that we're trying to define.
Brent Hinson and Bill Stowe, you heard in the first half hour when we had David Sedlak with us talk about the need to be more decentralized with water system. Is that something, Bill Stowe, that you could see in the foreseeable future? Does that make sense to you?
There's certainly elements of that that make a lot of sense. You know, his basic theme is that by decentralizing a lot of the conveyance costs, the piping costs, the interconnectedness with older systems are reduced. And there's a great deal, I think, to be said for that on the sewer side of our business. And again, it's kind of implicit in what all of us are saying, but there's something in our trade called one water, and that's the idea that sewer, rain, and drinking water are all interrelated. And to focus on one particular aspect without recognizing the systemic impacts elsewhere among that triangle of three issues can be a little bit off-putting. But the idea of decentralization, particularly on local sewage treatment, makes a lot of sense. As Iowans, many of us grew up with septic systems. We understand them. It forces us to recognize that just putting something down the drain doesn't necessarily mean getting it away from our property and from our interests forever. And there's a certain accountability there that's important. When it comes to water treatment itself, unlike Brent as an example, again, we're surface water treaters. Many of us as Iowans grew up on wells. Most of the United States and most of the largest cities, certainly in Iowa, rely on surface water, not well water. And that has a little bit different connotation from centralization, decentralization dimensions, meaning that I think that typology can be just a little bit misleading. I think it's always important to look at new technologies and how they can apply economically for specific customers, getting away from older infrastructure and conveyance costs, that is the piping costs, certainly makes a lot of sense. Climate change issue is very important in my business also, as we look at periods not only of drought and periods of flooding. Most of our infrastructure is built on floodplains, and that's intentional and something that's largely inevitable, I think, in our business, but it has consequences with climate change issues. But climate change issues also involve temperature, and water use in particular is very susceptible to temperature sensitivity. In our market, you and I as residential users will use almost three times as much water in the summer as we do in the winter. And a lot of that is because of horticultural needs, not because what we're doing inside our house, but what we're doing outside our house. So there are a lot of factors here that come into play when we talk about centralization versus decentralization. at the end of the day, I think we all point towards a greater need for investment in water and wastewater systems and stormwater systems, flood protection systems. And the challenge is working through a political system. Most of these systems are publicly owned in a way that our policymakers can be supportive of rate increases that are far larger, realistically, than the consumer price index, and that most people's wage indices go up. So a lot of work needs to be done doing exactly what we're doing here today, and that's
raising awareness. Mm-hmm. And we can expect higher water bills in the future, and understanding why that would be is what we're trying to do today. Running out of time here, David Swartney, tell us, you're involved in something called the Water Sustainability Initiative at the university. Explain that quickly.
Sure. So it's a few years back, in response to the floods, Iowa City is definitely a community that's in tune with its water resources, and the university wanted to show some buy-in, and they established what was called a cluster hire, so 10 faculty from different disciplines, all in one way or another interested in water, that came together. I'm part of that hire. It's a really great diverse group that thinks about water being much more than an engineer or a scientist problem. It's everybody's problem. So we've got people even in journalism and mass communication that can help on the raising awareness and communicating water issues. And it's been great. It's brought together a lot of existing strengths at the UI campus. And I think we'll see some really exciting outputs from that group as their careers blossom.
Okay, let's quickly go to some input from our listeners. Larry is in Nevada. Hi, Larry. Welcome to our program. Not much time, but what's your comment or your question?
Well, it seems like what we need is a nitrogen tax. Whether, you know, we apply so much nitrogen on the ground and then we leave cities like Des Moines to deal with it or other communities, if we just tax nitrogen, whether it was pig manure or chemical nitrogen, we'd have a revenue source that we could use to help pay for the pollution it's producing, or to help the farmers put in processes that would allow them to reduce the nitrogen they use or keep it on their farms.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Larry in Nevada. Bill Stowe, since Des Moines was addressed there, what do you think of that proposal?
Well, great comments. Larry is calling from my hometown. I'm a Nevadan, not to be confused with a Nevadan. the basic focus on nutrient pollution, and particularly nitrogen, has got to be critical. And the problem is the current system pushes the cost of nitrogen use to end users of water, like those of us in the Metro Des Moines area. I'm perfectly supportive of the premise of his point.
Let's talk about maybe David Swartney. You can address the political dimensions of this, because if anything is going to move, it has to move in the political dimension to happen. So tell us, I can see your face, it's not an easy challenge, is it?
It's not an easy challenge at all. I mean, when I think of the nitrogen issue and the nutrient issue just in general, it's very difficult here because nutrients are so important. I mean, using fertilizer is so important to the well-being for agriculture in the state, and agriculture is such a driver in the state. I'm drawn to tying it back to some of the things that David Sedlak talks about, is that we could use some of their ideas for decentralized treatment to maybe find ways to better manage nitrogen in runoff and think about treatment at points of discharge. It's a little more challenge for the diffuse sources, these non-point sources out of ag, but even then there might be some nice passive ways. A lot of research at the University of Iowa looking at ways in which we can use natural buffer strips, riparian zones, trees to try to mitigate some of that nitrogen runoff. It's going to take a collective group of both advances in technology as well as some political sacrifices. But in general, water policy is sometimes referred to as the third rail of politics. It's a dangerous one to go down, and politicians are usually quite wary.
David, let me throw this to you with our remaining 2 minutes, an email from Joe. While we worry about the environmental repercussions of seafood caught in distant oceans, few of us consider the environmental consequences of choosing pork products at the grocery or while dining out. We can best let the corporate agriculture giants that own most of the pigs in Iowa know how we feel by refusing to buy their products. So tell us about the water treatment problems caused by the CAFOs, for instance.
Sure. I think there's definitely nutrient concerns in terms of the runoff from manure and waste that's generated as a byproduct of those concentrated feeding operations. I think we're all beginning to be far more aware of the antibiotics and the steroids and everything else.
Could that be decentralized so that it didn't run into the Des Moines water system, for instance?
I've talked to some farmers that I know are very much interested in trying to find ways where they can do some level of on-site treatment to mitigate the discharge is coming from their facilities. And I think that they're concerned about any sort of looming threats. And when regulations come down the pipe, they're going to have to find ways to adapt to make sure that their processes stay economically viable. I think they'll listen. They'll have to find the right people to work with to make sure the technologies that they try to rely on do work, and that they have the monitoring strategies to make sure that they're maintained. Otherwise, the mitigation strategies will do no good.
Brent Hinson, in Washington, Iowa, what do you worry about most when you see the future and the future of water quality and systems here?
Well, I think as it relates to, you know, the non-point discharge things that were discussed with the ag interests, I think that just good state leadership and a pragmatic approach is important. I think that there are many very well-intentioned people within agriculture that would be willing to take a look at, kind of asymmetric solutions, things that are a little bit different than what's been tried to date, water quality trading, some of those sorts of things. I think that Iowa's past experience has shown what is most successful is a cooperative approach.
Okay, Brent Hinson, we have to go. I'm sorry. So much still to talk about in terms of on the water issue. City Administrator in Washington, Iowa, Brent Hinson, thank you for joining us. Bill Stowe, Des Moines Water Works CEO and General Manager, and David Swerting, Associate Professor in Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Iowa. Thank you all so much for joining our conversation. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth in Des Moines. We had help from John Pemble. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow, you want to stay tuned until we have a News Buzz edition Friday. Al Jarreau will come back to Iowa next week. We'll talk with him tomorrow. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.